North 2. I'm Corey from Peaked.fm, a platform for electronic musicians and enthusiasts. Today, I speak with Robin Vincent of Molten Music Technology. You may know him from his YouTube channel. We talk about education, creating modules, bringing people together into event spaces and performance spaces, and the inspiration of what performing and producing music does for us, and also some cool gear. Enjoy this interview with Robin Vincent. Robin, thanks again for joining me today.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure to be here. What are we going to talk about?
We're going to talk about, first, I've got a couple of questions for you about how you got started into music. I wanted to know a little bit more about what inspired your education into electronic music.
You'll have to stop me from turning it into an enormously long rambling story. So I'll try to pull in the main points. I think I was fascinated from an early age in music, and particularly electronic music, although I wouldn't have put a name to it necessarily. But my dad had Vangelis records. I loved soundtrack music, sci-fi music, those sorts of things. And so very early on, that's what I was listening to way before I ever got into pop music or rock music or anything like that. I was consuming sort of bands like Sky and early Kraftwerk, I suppose, pre-electronic Kraftwerk, that sort of stuff. So I had a very odd, eclectic mix of music that I was listening to. And you listen to things on purpose. I mean, this is back in the 70s. So you would put a record on and you would listen to it with headphones on. You know, it wasn't something that was as quite as ubiquitous as it is now. So you're very focused and you're sitting there, you're reading all the sleeve notes, you're absorbing every single part of it down to the gear list and bits and pieces. So by the time I got into wanting to think about what I wanted to do after school, I was absolutely focused on getting into the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. That's all I wanted to do. I had sound effects records. On my Commodore 64, I had a little sound sampler that I would use. I had a little MIDI sequencer. My dad bought a DX100 at some point randomly because he was like an organist, a keyboard player. And from those little bits and pieces, I was multi-tracking with a dual tape deck, you know, that was just my dad's hi-fi, you know, going from one to the other, building up tracks and stuff. And all of that process I found completely fascinating. I mean, this is almost pre-teen I was sort of doing this, so quite early on. And then as I say, my focus was very much, I wanted to be in sound effects. I wanted to be making weird Doctor Who music, and the Radiophonic Workshop seemed absolutely perfect for that. But, you know, but then I discovered girls and, you know, other things, actually being cool and going outside as opposed to spending my whole time isolated in my own little world. And those sorts of ideas gradually sort of unfold as real life invites you out to do other things. But I never sort of lost that interest in the technology behind stuff. I had it all lined up from what we have in the UK, which is A levels, which is like the 16 to 18 before you go to college. So you have these A levels, and I was lined up to go to what was then called the London College of Furniture, which bizarrely, but it was a college in London that had a Fairlight, it had modular synthesizers. And it was the only music technology course in the country, as far as I was aware.
Wow.
So I was booked to go on to that. But sadly, I failed all my A-levels. I didn't get any of the results I was supposed to get. Again, girls and going out having a good time were an impact on that, I think, quite heavily. So I wasn't able to do that. And so I took other routes. I bought a guitar, left home, and I worked, funny enough, in air traffic control for a few years, again, just very randomly. But later on, when I popped out of that after a few years, I came back to the idea of going to do this course, which had now turned actually into a university course, and reapplied and went along to study musical instrument technology at what was now the London Guildhall University. So that was my roundabout sort of journey. But the interesting thing about that course is that it was very much, it was a very broad thing. I think music technology these days, when you're going on a course like that, you are probably going to learn how to use GarageBand on a Mac, probably. And you'll probably learn a little bit about mixers and live sound, and you'll make beats, and that's probably it. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot more to it, but that tends to be the thing. Whereas this course I did in my first year, I built a Baroque recorder, looked at guitar, guitar building. I did something on Chinese folk music, and then acoustics, sampling technology. This was early. This was pre-Pro Tools. So I think DigiDesign had released Sound Tools, and we were looking at that. Modular synthesis and electronics. So all of these things surrounding this idea of what music technology was about. It wasn't just electronics. It was how you build an instrument. I mean, I hand-built a xylophone with like an axe and chunks of wood and stuff like that, because we were trying to understand about how these things came together and how wood resonated and stuff like that. So it was very, very, very varied. So I was just looking if I had something to hand. and was brilliant. So within that, my intention of doing electronics, it moved out into, I built flutes, wooden flutes, for my final project. But with that, I also did a pitch to MIDI converter. So I was able to design a PCB and design a circuit that took the sound of the flute and then converted that into MIDI in order to play a Korg M1 that we had knocking around. I very thoroughly enjoyed sort of crashing into woodworking, into circuitry, electronics, but music, acoustics, all of these sorts of things all at once. And it was very, very mind-opening, I think, which has set me in good stead. I think I'm a very broad thinking person, and I think that's been one of the most important things for me in my journey through things, is not to be too focused on a minutiae and focused on a one particular element. It has its downsides. Like I don't understand or can't name electronic music genres. I just don't have any clue, but I can talk about music in a very, very wide range of ideas and concepts and that sort of thing. So that's sort of where my base comes from. I don't really have any proper musical training. I did do euphonium, which is a brass instrument, to grade 3 at school. And I played a bit of piano, but I hated piano lessons. What I did learn, I think, is triad chords, and on an automatic accompaniment type keyboard, you know, you just had to play a chord and everything else would happen for you. So I was very much a 3-finger chord and lead person on a keyboard, I think, which is stead me in good stead. These days, you know, when you're playing synths, you're very much playing pads of those sorts of things, rather than playing very tricky, intricate, jazzy bits and pieces. That's where my fundamentals come from. I think I feel like I'm a curious person. I get interested in different things. I'm unafraid to dabble and to try things out. I'm afraid to not get it right, you know, those sorts of things. So in some ways, perhaps even courageous on the right day. You could say perhaps that would be foolhardy, maybe in another way of looking at it. Those sorts of things. Destined never to quite succeed at anything, but have a good, jolly good go at anything that comes my way.
That's very good. That makes a lot of sense. And I understand completely of, you know, not really needing to or having to be able to exactly understand the different genres of music, but rather understand that music is a form of communication between people. And a lot of it is about understanding each other without speaking to each other.
Yeah, no, that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, it resonates with me very much. So another question I was curious about is I was looking at your website, and it looks like you play live on a regular basis. And I was curious about how your live rig is currently looking at for live performances and what might be changing slightly and what is maybe an evergreen modular or synthesizer that you like to use?
See, that's a good question. I generally abuse the idea of live performance in as much as because I mean, in some ways, the nature of my job is that as a reviewer of gear, which is part of what I do, I get a lot of stuff coming through, and I have to put time into all the things that are coming through. So I very rarely get the opportunity to have a system which stays the same. Because I get another module in and I need to stick that in that rack in order to use it with these bits so I can properly work out how it works and demo it and that kind of thing. And so I'm having to pull bits out, which then end up on a desk over here, or, you know, on this pile here, or maybe this pile over there, or maybe that pile over there. And so it's a very much a changeable feast. So when I'm looking to do a live performance, what that does for me, rather than it being a polished thing that I've been honing my skill with for a month or two, it gives me an opportunity just to focus down and try to see whether I can pull something interesting out of what I have in front of me. And it's in some ways it's quite challenging, in other ways it's lazy, in as much as perhaps I could put more work into doing something more polished. But I like the improvisational nature of that. I like the risk involved in trying to bring something out of modules that you don't necessarily know deeply. It's difficult to say whether the audience appreciates that or not, but it also depends on what it is. I mean, very often my performances are in EMOMs or that over there, electronic music open mics. So it's a turn up and play kind of event where you'll get 15, 20 minutes slotting with everybody else. And I am finding that I can definitely fill 15, 20 minutes full of something worth listening to, you know. And aiming for that is, it flexes your performance muscles and makes you think and work at something, but it doesn't have to like take over your life. I don't have to be a full-time performer. I don't have to put 6 weeks worth of practice into making that happen. Because if I did, then I would never do it. If I had to do that, it just wouldn't happen. Now, if I have the opportunity to play a larger gig, something longer, then I will absolutely work harder at that. But because most of my performances are sort of small and quick, then it gives me an opportunity to play around with some stuff, to see what I can come up with and, how many fancies I can tickle within that 15, 20 minutes. I mean, there are things that I would generally use all the time, I suppose. Although, I mean, I think there's phases. Like for a while I was using the SIG, the stochastic inspiration generator, as a focus of my melodies. Yeah, that I would use as a melody source, and very often attach that to the qubit surface, which gives this lovely string, twangy string sound. The combination of those two things works really, really well in sort of any environment, and then you can build stuff up around it. So I would get a little bit fixated on a couple of modules like that. What am I using at the moment? At the moment, for instance, I have a synth voice, which is a Pico VC, Pony, beg your pardon, Pony VCO from Befaco, which is a little small oscillator with a lovely, great sound to it. And I've got that going into I can never remember the name of it, Sunless City transistor ladder filter. And the combination of those two things is a really, really sweet sound. So I very much like using those whenever I get the opportunity. But in terms of what's running the show, in terms of sequencer, that changes all the time. There's a couple that I come back to, funnily enough. There's the Varigate Plus from... I see my memory is just not what it was. Again, I'll just give a look. it's not there. Where is it? Gosh darn it. You'll find it if you look up Varigate. It's just a little eight slider sequencer. It's an absolute pain in the ass to use because it has multiple menus that you select things and the sliders do different things depending on which button you got pressed on. And you never have the right button on. And you are always going to it and changing something by accident. And you like throw the tempo all over the place, or you suddenly change the sort of sequence it's using or the length of it or something when you were just trying to tweak a note. So there's a lot of annoying things with it, but I come back to it time and time again. It's a very quick turn it on. There's a nice little sequence going on. So things like that I tend to gravitate towards because I know that that they can do the job, do the business, you know. But I am always looking for the next great module, which is really going to do something interesting in my rack. And it shifts and it changes, and it's quite interesting. Like, for instance, at the moment, I've got a little percussive setup, which I really like. That's using the Diktak from Muzak, which is a little four-channel trigger sequencer, which has got these four sort of big buttons on the front, so you can tap out rhythms really, really quickly. Got that running into a couple of analog drum sounds, some 808 type sounds, and it's great. I haven't got to the bottom of it yet. I've only really scratched the surface, but it's so instant and so quick that it just allows you to pump out a quick pattern without having to worry about anything. And so in modular, you tend to, you know, have this little growth of stuff over here that's being patched together. So you've got your trigger sequencer module, and then a few modules grow up around it, and you think, well, maybe I'll need a mute switch, and then that grows up, and then I'll need to mix those sounds together, and a little mixer turns up, you know, and these things sort of grow like a little bit of mold on the side of your case, and it grows into a thing over here. And then one that's good, you can then go and worry about something else. So it's tricky for me to pick out individual modules that are really good, but you know, there's it's ever changing, I think, in my experience.
And on that note of ever changing and being inspired by different types of technologies and projects from these different modular companies and synthesizer companies, over the past couple of years, you've actually produced a couple of modules yourself, the Molten Bypass and the Molten, where was it? The Motion Meter. Yes. You also got your, the Molten Plasma, which I was very curious about, which is what the samples from the Game Changer Audio Plasma Voice.
Yeah.
I was curious about how you came up with the ideas for these designs and how you were able to get these projects together with the FACO and so on.
Yeah, great. I've been very, very fortunate in being able to get a couple of ideas across to somebody. Because, I mean, it's one of those things that once you start in modular, you very quickly believe yourself to be an expert and believe that, oh, if only people did it like this, or why doesn't it work like this, you know, because that seems obvious to me. There seems to be this big hole in this or a big hole in that, when in actual fact most stuff does already exist. Most ideas have already been had, but every now and again you come across something where you think, well, you know, I would really like this, or there's a particular function in some module that you think would be worthwhile having in some other form. When I first thought about making my own module and I approached Bafaco, Manu at Bafaco is brilliant. He's such an approachable guy. He's so into stuff and is enthusiastic about the nature of modular and what can be done. That he's very encouraging and sort of says, yeah, no, absolutely, let's talk about it. So my first idea was this ridiculously complex, essentially voltage controlled mixer, many, many channels. And it was going to be this, you know, if I have a voltage controlled mixer, not only can I mix stuff, I can then control it. So it could then perhaps be a sequencer. It could also be this, it could be a modulator, it could be all this. And Manu's like, okay, why don't we start with an attenuator? It's like, oh, right, okay. So we've got the level here. He doesn't really want to spend all his company's resources in coming up with some enormously complex module. What is helpful in the marketplace and in the community is something which simply does something useful. So if you can find something useful that's perhaps not been done before, or maybe been done differently, that has an individual spin on it, then that actually could be a useful thing that people would buy. And so I went sort of back away with that thought and thought, okay, so something actually useful. And one of the things that I had found frustrating in moving from software to hardware, because I was very much a software-based person for many, many years. When I moved into hardware, which has been a complete delight, but the thing that I felt was missing was sort of the visualization that software gives you. While hardware is very tactile, and there are lights and bits and pieces, there's very, very rarely do you have any automated knobs or anything showing you what modulation is doing. So you could modulate a filter cutoff, for instance, with an LFO, and that in software is spinning around, jumping around as you change it, and you can see what's happening. And for me, a visual connection to the sound, to what is happening orally, to me is enormously helpful in identifying what's going on. In software, you see all this animation going on, and that is missing in hardware. So once something is patched, I'm forever following cables, you know, going down the end of a cable, trying to work out what is that plugged into, and okay, that's plugged in over there, and that's doing that. And so I was looking for a way, there must be a way to visualize this better. You know, could I put a ring of LEDs around something to show its modulation? And that is really where the motion meter came from, wanting to be able to see the LFO, see in my mind. I mean, I'm sure most LFOs come with LEDs that glow and then disappear and then glow and disappear to give you some idea. I just wanted something more obvious. And so having a halo around a knob seemed to me to be a great way to show that. And then it was just a matter of trying to work out how can you usefully plug that into Eurorack? And actually, is there more that you can do once you've got that? So you're routing your modulation into the motion meter, which is then displaying that. If you have a few channels of that, could you mix that together? Could you monitor audio as well as modulation? You know, those sorts of things. And chatting to Bafaco, we were able to just extend the feature set a little bit to make it more useful. They've got a great handle on design over there, so they were able to make it slightly more interesting than how I presented it to them, which is great. And they give you ideas and, hey, we could do this and we could do that. And so it definitely came about through a conversation, trying to see that there's a thing that could happen. How easy is it to make that happen? How useful would that be? And then there's a discussion in trying to make that, get that to the right point. I mean, that we did have some versions that had a lot more sort of mixing potential going on, but it just got too complicated. And it's very easy for features, what they call feature creep, for it just to get too complex to the point where it becomes, you know, this isn't really working. You've lost the first thing it was supposed to do. And when you have an opportunity to make a module, you want to pile in as many features as you can think of. You just think, oh yeah, but it could do this and it could do this. So it's very wise just to back off a bit and think, well, if you can do the basic thing we're trying to do, if you can do that right, and then perhaps a little bit more, you just then need to stop. Otherwise, you're never going to get it finished, or no one's ever going to understand it. So I think the motion meter, I'm enormously pleased with it. I think it's a great little module. I use it all the time. So it's not as if it's, I had this idea and now I don't care anymore. No, I still find it very useful, particularly in tying together. For instance, with three channels, you can tie together an envelope and an LFO going into like a filter. And then you have the output of the filter going through a third channel, which is just controlling the level. So you've got a little sort of, it becomes a little control module for a synth voice, which is very, very nice. I use another one for mixing together three drums. So I've got kick, snare and hi-hats going through. And you can see what's going on, because in that buzz of a live performance, when there's so much going on and there's so much noise, to be able to see something is happening, as well as, because you're not necessarily connecting it with your ears all the time, is very, very helpful. So yeah, that one's worked really well. The bypass was a little bit more sort of deliberately trying to solve a problem, in that I was frustrated that you can't bypass effects in Eurorack because it just doesn't exist as a thing. So it seems sometimes one or two. I remember on the Strymon Magneto, that big chunky tape thing, that I never quite got on with that, but I did use it a few times. But that had a bypass CV input. And it was, and I would use it a lot in sending it a very slow clock to just turn it on and off. So it would like grab your signal and then throw out these tape delays, and then it would turn off and then it would come back on again. And that was a really nice function. And so I sort of took that idea, I think, and tried to work out how can you do that in a module in a way that, again, is creative and interesting. And it does work like that. I don't always use them because it's another module to stick in when you think you're already going through a bunch of stuff, and you can turn things down and turn the mix knobs on effects and stuff. But every now and again, I pull one out and put it in, and it is quite brilliant. Particularly, you can do things like you can give it a quick on and off, and it creates this sort of tremolo as well as sort of pumping out washes of effects as it goes through stuff. So you can use it in all sorts of interesting ways. So again, Befeco were very, very supportive and understood what it was we were trying to do, which is the important thing. So yeah, that's been great. I've loved doing that. It's been very exciting. I do have we are cooking up another one at the moment. It takes a long time, much longer than I thought. You gotta give it at least a year or so from talking about the idea to actually getting to the point where you could have the thing. So it's a long term thought, I suppose. But yeah, more to come on that, I think, which would be great. Do you want me to talk about the software thing as well?
Yes, please. That'd be great.
So it's not my crazy idea. I'm always up for another idea, right? And so, yeah. And a number of people have been. I mean, I was always fascinated by people who create sample packs for stuff, because I've never been interested in a sample pack in my life. I don't. You know, I get a bunch of samples usually on a CD when you buy an audio interface or something like that. Samples do appear from places, but it's never occurred to me to be a thing to go and buy. And so I've always been fascinated when people go, oh yes, here's my review of this synthesizer and here's my sample pack. It's like, well, why would anybody want that? But slowly over time, you get to understand, oh yeah, but if you can't afford to buy the synth, then actually having a few of the sounds in a sampled instrument means that you could, you know, feasibly use those sounds. So yeah, I reassessed and thought, okay, that's an interesting idea. And there was people like Venus Theory who was creating not just sample packs, was creating actual instruments that their patrons could have, or that he was selling through his website. And I thought, you know, that's a better idea. Rather than a sample pack, to actually be able to give people, or to sell people, or to make available some kind of virtual instrument. How hard could that be, I thought. Turns out not too hard, but you know, there's a little bit of hardness in there. But using a free open source sampler instrument called Decent Sampler, you can build instruments within that with a little bit of coding. It's very sort of focused on coding. It's not difficult coding. I mean, I'm not a coder, but I've spent enough time with computers and fixing problems to be able to recognize stuff and copy and paste it. As in, I can basically, what I did is I bought one of Venus Theory's synths. I downloaded it. I pulled the file apart and went, oh, okay, that's how you do it. And then kind of copy and pasted that code and then started working on that in order to put my own stuff in. As I say, it's all open source, so I could have done it through GitHub and things like that, but it just seemed easier to use the example of someone who had already done it in order to try to work that out for myself. So my intention is to sample stuff as I go and create these little instruments, which I then put online for my patrons, my long-suffering patrons who don't get a whole lot, and also potentially to sell them out to the world if people are interested in buying these sample sets put together as virtual instruments. It's a nice idea, I think. It's a nice idea. It's labor intensive is the downside. But it's like the plasma one, right? That's the first one I put together, and I spent a couple of weeks putting it together, which is, there's no way I'm getting that time or money back, I don't think. But it was a process in learning how that works and how the thing works. But I did like multiple round robins, I did velocity layering, you know, everything in a multi-sampled, multi-instrument. And it was brilliant. You know, two people liked it. That's great. So on my next one, you know, sod the velocity layers. There's velocity because you hit it harder and it just gets louder. Round robins, I don't know that I'm interested anymore. Just give us the basic sound. So I've simplified it down a little bit just to make it feasible. Otherwise, it's just going to take too long to do. But I hope to keep doing it. I've done one on the Mantis. I hope to do one on, I got it here. I did this, reviewed this drum machine recently, this little analog drum machine or drum sound source. So I'm going to do a little bit of that and sort of run it through some processes and stuff to try to create different sounds with it and make that available. And just generally as I can, when I can find the time, just keep sort of adding to that little library of stuff, and hopefully that'll end up being, you know, end up being useful. That's what you hope.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. I like that a lot. Thank you very much for explaining every bit you've designed. This is really fun stuff, and that makes so much more sense about the idea of a sample pack of, like, if you can't afford the actual synthesizer, here's a sample pack I've made that you can buy that's a lot cheaper.
Yeah. And also that there's crazy things like polyphony, because, you know, many of these synthesizers we have are monophonic and you get the one sound, and suddenly if I sample it, I've got a, you know, a 16 voice polyphonic version of that. Obviously you've not got the same you know, creative input onto it, but you've got a filter and reverb and delay and envelopes and such like you can apply to that source material. So it really does give you a whole different way of looking at it by taking that sound. I mean, there's people who essentially sample all the time, and that's their workflow, that again I'd never really considered. Recently I was, because I've just reviewed the, it's just over there, the Instruo Seashell. I just posted that video this morning, which is a fabulous little synthesizer, and Jeremy at Red Means Recording had done a video on it a few days earlier. And what he did, his approach to it, was he had a Digitac, I think it is, an Electron box, and the Seashell, and he just made a sound, sampled it into the Digitac, set that going, made another sound, sampled that in, set that going, and very quickly built up these layers of sound using this monophonic semi-modular synthesizer as the sound source, and yet producing, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 different sounds and layering them together and producing a track with it. And I thought that was quite brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Of course, people do these things all the time, but you don't realize until you do, if you know what I mean. Always assumed you use everything kind of live and record that as it happens, as opposed to just pulling out a sound and then using that as your sound source to sequence and something else. You know, there's so many different ways and different approaches to doing this sort of thing, but it just highlighted how you don't have to have 8 synths to produce 8 layers of sound. You can have one little synth that you sample in and then can do all sorts of different things with. You know, so many different approaches.
That's something that I've always admired about what Electron does, is creating these synthesizers that can do sampling and create layers and have triggers and have sequences all set up so that you, and of course it takes time to really understand what's going on inside of it to really get a composition ready to perform on that. So it's a little different approach than playing with modular, where a lot of modular, if you're doing analog, a lot of it you can just perform live, and there's not a lot of presets compared to with using Electron or any type of digital synthesizer, where you are really going to be diving in ahead of time and designing, going through the presets and creating your own sound, sampling, and setting up these timelines of sequences so that you can set them up to go off when you want to at the exact time through your performance. So it really does take a lot more focus to really set that up for any performance compared to what we play with modular, which is much more, a bit more of an experiment.
It is. I mean, it gets to this idea of, the validity behind your music making and where that comes from, I suppose. At an EMOM recently, I did a little bit of modular, did a modular improvisation that I'd been working on sort of that afternoon, took in a couple of boxes of stuff, and it was okay. I didn't do it quite as well as I'd hoped, but, you know, it went off. But the guy after me had multiple synthesizers in racks. He had a laptop, he had Ableton Live running, he had masses of controllers and lights and launch pads and all this kind of thing. And looking at his screen in Ableton, there was just stacks and stacks and stacks of clips that he was launching and going. And he did this entire sort of EDM set where everyone was bouncing around. And I'm going, but he's evidently had spent a lot of time crafting that whole set together, you know. And in some ways it feels like, oh yeah, but that's a bit pre-programmed. But then he'd put so much work and sweat into creating this fantastic sound and environment for people to enjoy, whereas I'd spent like half an afternoon and expected people to listen to my meanderings on a bit of modular. You know, there's so many different ways of looking at it, and there's always a danger that we're trying to find our validation in one way of doing it or another, when that doesn't have to matter. All of these things can be interesting and exciting, and the modular approach requires, I think, you invest time and energy into it in a different way to someone who's working on a laptop or working in a DAW. There's a different energy to it, and you know, both of those energies are very valid. It's just it has a different feel, and that always fascinates me. Always fascinates me how people, the workflow that people use and what they see as their way of expressing themselves through the technology that we have access to.
That makes so much sense, because I was speaking with Eden Gray. We had her on the podcast a couple weeks ago.
Oh yeah, great. Yeah,
and we were talking about, of course, synthesizers and the inspirations. And Eden says, every time I play my synthesizer, I go to space, and that's something that that resonates with me a lot. Of playing modular is you're experimenting and you're exploring new spaces in audio. And it is very much kind of a going into space and creating a zen within your own element, and very much a form of meditation when you really allow yourself to get lost into the groove. And you are, and even another friend of mine, Musical Fungus, once said that he's having a conversation with the synthesizer. And that sometimes he's playing the synthesizer and sometimes the synthesizer is playing him.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's interesting. And I completely can identify with that, I think. I guess the question it throws up is how much of that you should impose upon other people and how much of it you should keep to yourself. I know that that Eden does live patch from scratch stuff. I've seen her do that a few times. And yeah, the first 5 minutes, there's just kind of a tone going on. She's gradually patching stuff together. And it's brilliant. And she takes it to, you know, extraordinary places. But it does require quite a bit of patience and input and attention from the crowd, you know, which is good. You know, I don't think everything should just be disposable and throwaway or should just be the hits. I think it's good that we spend time doing these things, because we can often be afraid of that, of allowing things to be too long. We're told we need things to be short, sharp, and instant to the point and snappy. And I think modular, in terms of in what it's done to me, is it has sort of reinforce this idea of long term, of longer pieces of music, of allowing things to develop, not going too fast. I mean, that's an interesting phenomenon, I think, is that when you're practicing something and practicing for an EMOM or for a performance, you might spend a few hours on this patch moving things about and chasing it around. And within that 2 hours, there were some fantastic moments, but there's also some dross and some rubbish and some bits that weren't really working until it sort of had to pull together. But then you've got to somehow take all of that and bundle it into a short performance in front of people. And that's quite a challenge. Quite a big challenge. And what I've tend to find a few times is that you do everything far too quick. So, you know, you've been practicing and you've come up with a few ideas. You've got those ideas. Yeah, you know, I've got the kick drum to drop in. I've got that thing can turn on. I can then mix that with that thing. And in the stress of a live performance, and the fact that you don't want there to be silence, or you're thinking, well, I've got these four notes going around and I've been doing that now for 20 seconds, you know, can they stand another 4 minutes of that? I don't know. And so you then drop in your kick and then you drop in your other thing and you suddenly think, oh, I'm only 5 minutes in and I've used all of my cool gadgets, used all my cues. So trying to resist dropping everything in too quick is definitely something you have to train into yourself. I think you just have to go, no, I'm going to sit here and for 5 minutes this is going to go around and it's going to be fine. I'm just going to tweak that filter a little bit. You know, we need that. That requires practice as much as anything else, is to resist throwing in all of your best stuff straight away. You know, you need somewhere to go to. The other side of that is that when you have run out of everything, it forces you to have to then improvise properly. So, you know, so I've got 5 minutes left. Oh my goodness, I'm going to have to try to come up with something else at this point. And that can get quite exciting.
No, it really is. And I do also have the same resistance of I need to open my filter slowly to make sure that, you know, you get that nice resonance coming up at that nice roundabout feeling, so that it has that slow build into it instead of just kind of just turning everything on. Because I too have that situation as I'm performing, I've got everything turned on and I'm too excited and I want to start just turning all the knobs and turning all the volumes up and getting everything set up. But I need to remind myself, I need to cue everything at the right time. And this is part of that premeditative performance aspect of being prepared and really doing a rehearsal a couple times before you actually try to perform live. But there's also the anticipation of someone who wants to just get out on the stage and just perform. And sometimes we need to do that to realize, okay, maybe I should have thought about and prepared a little bit more so that I got the result that I wanted for the live audience.
Yeah, there's definitely something in that. I mean, practice is definitely a thing that needs to be done. But I would also say that it shouldn't become a barrier. You shouldn't let the idea that it has to be some form of perfect or it has to be really good before you can come out and present it to people. Because, I mean, places like EMOM are perfect for just trying stuff out, to be unafraid to give things a go. Because if you're waiting until that track is really, really good, then you're unlikely to ever get it out there. Whereas you will learn so much trying to perform it in front of people that it is an absolutely valid and valuable lesson to go through, even when you've just got a few ideas as opposed to a perfectly formed track, you know. So don't let the perfectionist within you prevent you from giving things a go out there in the real world, you know. But at the same time, I know people who take notes, you know, they write things down. Okay, I'll do this at this time. I'll do this at this time. And that's also a really good idea. And I must do that sometime. It will be really interesting to do that. I think I like the idea that I'll be in a position where I have a system which is stable and will stay there long enough for me to actually develop an idea on it. I like the idea of that very much, and will endeavor to try to give that a go. I think if I get a longer gig at some point, I will see that as a challenge to try to put together a bit more of a script. I mean, it's always going to be improvised to a degree, because it only takes a tiny slip of a finger to suddenly change an octave on an oscillator, or just knock it out of tune, and you're suddenly having to bring that back together again. You know, it's very easy to go astray on a modular, but that's part of its charm, you know, and that's part of what takes you off to try to do something else.
Absolutely. Now, speaking of live music, I saw that you also organize one of the electronic music meetups, or is it a convention out there in the UK?
Yeah, very much. Yeah, Syntheast it's called, because I live in the east of England, a place called East Anglia, or Norfolk as such. Oddly, Norfolk would you think would be in the north. I mean, we are just above Suffolk, which you'd think would be in the south, but we're actually on the eastern lug that sticks out the side of England. But, you know, our naming conventions never really meant anything, because it was a long time before, yeah. We knew how large our land was, I suppose. But anyway, so in the east of England, there's this event, Syntheast, that we started up a few years ago, which has been great. I mean, these synthesizer shows or conventions are increasingly vital, I think, because of the nature of the industry at the moment, with music shops closing left, right, and center. We recently had a music shop called PMT. There was 11 of these stores around the country, and they all just closed overnight. And it means that Norwich and Norfolk, where I am, there's no music shop that sells high-tech gear. There's guitar shops and flute shops and brass shops, piano shops, but there's nothing that sells synthesizers or pro audio gear, really. So it's become increasingly helpful to have an opportunity for people to come and try out synthesizers and talk to manufacturers and that kind of thing. It's a brilliant event. I mean, if I say so myself, but these sorts of events are brilliant, whether it's Knobcom or Bristronica, as we have over here, or Superbooth. You know, all of these things are fantastic opportunities, and they're very much based on doing something interesting in the community. It's not like NAMM, you know, the NAMM show in
yes.
the woods to some degree.
Yes, yeah, Richard and I went there in January this year.
Oh, right. Great. I haven't been for a long, long time. Went years and years ago. But that's very much a trade show based on selling products to shops, and how do we get those products out there to sell. It's very much a marketing and sales situation.
Yes.
Whereas these synthesizer shows are much more based on, this is a really cool synthesizer. Do you want to go? You know, have a look at this. I'm going to bring my stuff in. Of course, there's sales and marketing involved in all that, but it's a much more of a celebration of synthesis and celebration of technology than it is just a taking orders and talking about margin sort of show. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. It makes a lot more sense because, you know, we went to Superbooth last year, and that was a joy. That was, to me, it was just like it might be the biggest synthesizer convention in the world. I think it is.
I think so, yeah.
And that was the treat to really get a chance to go to that. That was amazing. I went to Synthplex back in 2019 when that happened for the first time. And we went to, besides going to NAMM back in January at the same weekend, also Booklet and Friends was happening
yes.
in Los Angeles, so we went to that as well. Great. And to us, of course, that's like, that's our bread and butter right there. That's, you know, because so you walk in and it's like, I know half the people here, this is great. And you just run it to everybody and have a great conversation and talk about the synthesizers, and you get to test everything, and that is so fun. And we're probably going to go to NobCon as well this year in September over in Schaumburg in Illinois, which I've not been to before, and I'm looking forward to going to that one because I know there's a bunch of I'll know a few of the locals who are going to be there out of the Illinois area. That's going to be really fun. And when is Synth East? Is that, has that already happened this year?
It has happened, yeah. We have it in February. We were looking for sort of a dead time, I suppose, because in and sort of the synthesizer calendar, May tends to be Superbooth, January tends to be NAMM to some degree, so many of the manufacturers that we would invite would be over in America. So you wanted a bit of space. There used to be the Frankfurt show in March, but that's not really a thing. Music Messe, it was called. That's not really a thing anymore. And then things like Bristronica and Synth Fest over in the UK are in October time. Nobody wants to do anything in the summer. There is summer NAMM, but that tends to be more of a pro audio event. So it seemed February seemed to be good. You know, it's far enough past Christmas for people to have started to wake up again, but there's nothing really exciting going on. So it seemed to be a good thing to plump for. So yeah, we're thinking, starting to think about, next year's show. Not a whole lot is changing, I don't think. We've sort of maxed out our venue, but it's working very, very well. So we don't want to necessarily, is that my stomach? Don't necessarily want to mess with the format particularly, because it has, you know, it's just been really, really great how it's worked. So we might probably stick to the same thing, but we have to find performances and performers and acts for the evening and various bits and pieces. So there's lots of things to think about and to get through before we sort of open up bookings for the show in after the summer.
Very good. Robin, again, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me on North 2 for Peak.fm. This has been such a treat to chat with you for a little bit and get to know a little bit about more of the productions you've been working on over the years, and just a delight to chat.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been lovely. I'm always happy to talk, as you can tell. I could talk nonstop for many, many hours. It's been great. Thanks for giving me some time and asking me interesting questions. And it's always great to meet a colleague. And super. Thank you.